Okay, ladies and gentlemen, we are live. Welcome to episode 30 of Logos Academy. Today's going to be the last show of the week. I hope you guys had a very good week and have a good weekend. Let me just get this last chat room pulled up here, and then we'll be ready to kick it off. All right, as usual, we're live on Rumble, Odyssey, FTJ. We're live on Rumble Studio, and we're live on Twitter as well. As you can see by the title, we're going to be starting a Mein Kampf reading today. Now, again, this is going to be a long series. The book is it's over 600 pages. No, I'm sorry, it's actually just on. Well, it's over, I guess, if you count the index. It's just under 600 pages. It's 599 pages. So we're going to be doing a reading of this for the next however many shows. I don't know how long this will take. Chapter 1 is a pretty short chapter, so we're going to be able to hammer that out just today. And if the show ends a little early, it'll end early because obviously I don't want to start chapter 2, read like 3 pages, and then end the show. So we're going to focus just on chapter 1 today. And then on the next episode, we'll go to chapter 2. Chapter 2 is a lot longer, so that's probably going to take 2 or 3 episodes to read. There's also a lot to analyze in chapter 2. There's probably a little bit less to analyze in chapter 1, so there's going to be less of me pausing and kind of drawing comparisons to the modern age, looking at, you know, some of the things that he discusses, and especially in chapter 2, for example, of his awakening process when he's starting to see all of the corruption around him in society, the sources of this corruption. He's analyzing politicians, their behaviors, the reason that some of these politicians become corrupt, how the system itself is flawed. We're going to see a lot of comparison in the modern American, quote unquote, democratic system. So there will be a lot more analysis. I don't think there's going to be all that much in chapter one. And I do want to preface by informing everybody my German is not great. So if I give some German words, might sound a little bit scratchy here and there. I don't speak good German. I'm good with the spelling, good with the reading, like reading of it physically, but I'm not very good with the speech yet. So I'm in the process of learning that, as well as many other things I'm learning at the same time. So it's a slow process. With that said, I want to promote a couple things that we're doing for the rest of the week and I guess the rest of the month. We have a lot going on. So today's gonna be the last show of the week. I'm not gonna have a show this weekend. We were supposed to have quite a few shows this week. We ended up only having 3. Yesterday's show, if you guys were excited for that, I know quite a few people were. Unfortunately, yesterday's show got canceled. Michelle Renouf, who was one of our guests, she is not tech savvy. She was having a hard time getting a microphone to function. So we rescheduled out to the 28th of this month, which is a Tuesday. It's going to be at 4 p.m. Eastern, same time. And by then, we'll have her all set up so that we can actually have the call. We can hear her, she can hear us, and everything's working very well. It was about a 30 to 40 minute endeavor trying to get that figured out yesterday. So we had to just cancel the show because we only had an hour with Lana, and I wanted to make sure that she was on the whole time. So a little bit of a conflict there technologically, but we will be doing that show just a little bit further in the future. This coming Monday, we've got, you know, Logos Academy is kicking back up 4 to 6 p.m. Eastern, like always. I'm also going to be in a space at 7 p.m. Eastern. If you guys are familiar on Twitter, they are doing JQ Radio. One in the chat, if you guys are familiar with JQ Radio, two, if you are not. I think most people probably know what JQ Radio is. It's been getting pretty big. A lot of people seem to be taking interest in that. A little bit, Skitten. A little bit. A little bit. Yes, we are starting at the very beginning of Mein Kampf. Yep. Walther, welcome. Joker, Owie, we got Delta, Skitten. Hello. Ruthless, hello. Got a Loyals viewer, nice to see. JQ Radio's a shit show. I disagree. I think it's pretty nice. Well, actually, I haven't been in a lot, so I can't give like a serious assessment, but a lot of the episodes that I've listened to I thought were pretty good. I don't really go in spaces as much as I used to, so it's hard to say. But with that being said, I will be co-hosting JQ Radio at 7 p.m. Eastern on this coming Monday. We're going to be talking about National Socialism as a political ideology. We're going to lay out some of the economics behind it, some of the organizational process. We're also going to talk about how we move forward as a country individually or even locally, how we can start to formulate some things, right? Again, constantly on my show, in spaces, I'm constantly having people ask, what's next? Where do we go? Where do we move, right? So we're going to be discussing some of that in that Twitter space on Monday, trying to give people a little bit of direction. Then on the 22nd, we've got our typical 4 to 6 Logos Academy episode. On the 23rd, which is Thursday, I was invited onto Jose Nino's show. It's going to be at 8 p.m. Eastern. I'm not entirely familiar with him. He was a guest at the same time as me on Red Ice on their New Year's kind of like blowout show. So I'll be with him at 8 p.m. Eastern next Thursday. I'll be posting a link up on my Twitter so you guys can check that out. Then on Friday of next week at 4 p.m. Eastern on our typical Logos Academy show, we're going to have Antelope Hill Publishing on for an interview. A couple of the guys that are in the inner working of Antelope Hill Publishing. Again, if you guys aren't familiar with Antelope Hill, they are a book publishing company. You can find them at antelopehillpublishing.com. I just partnered with them this week, so if you go on there and you want to get a book, they have like 80 or 90 book options on the website. If you find something that you're interested in, you want to pique your interest with a little bit of intellectual reading, code LOGOS, L-O-G-O-S, you're going to save yourself 10% on the book. So that's a very nice deal I got with them. Great people. They're actually very local to me. I might actually be meeting them in person. They're very local to me, so I'm going to kind of get to know them a little bit, speak with them, and potentially be reading some of, or not reading the books on the show, but analyzing some of the books on the show and having on the authors as guests in the future. So I'm very interested to do that. Skitten, they're more of a casual show. I love the people behind Red Ice. Both Lana and Heinrich, they're amazing people. But I do agree there is a bit of that disorganization maybe on the format of the show. Like when I was on, it's more relaxed. It's more of like, hey, we're going to watch some clips and kind of hang out. It's not an atmosphere for me. I don't know if they ever do like real serious shows, but obviously, you know, I like to have like really deep discussion. I like to go very in depth into social and psychological and philosophical problems. I'm a chatterbox in that field, right? I love analyzing things and kind of breaking things down, trying to discuss the nuances of stuff. And that was more kind of relaxed, which for most people, they would prefer that, and it would be really fun for them. For me, it's actually very tough. I have a hard time just sitting and kind of relaxing, kind of kicking back and watching some silly clips or something. It feels very weird to me. Hicks, great. I'm very excited to do this. My chat very much liked when I was doing this before. We read two or three chapters out of this, and they really enjoyed it. And by the way, brother, I have to get back to your email. I'm sorry I haven't done that. Emails, again, I always apologize to people. Emails are like the very last thing I get back to. Sometimes it actually might take me a month to get back to your email. Emails are really hard for me. So one thing I really don't like to check. I've never been an email person. My old email account before I started doing this show and created an email specifically for it, I think it's 18,000 unread emails. I'm terrible at reading emails. It's one of the worst things for me. So please do understand that. Good, Salty Earth, I'm glad. I think you'll really enjoy that platform. They got a lot of really good books on there. Good stuff on National Socialism, Fascism, Christian Nationalism, all these different categories. Western culture, Western philosophy, things like that. I am going to try to encourage them, as well as a couple other companies, to start publishing more philosophy works. This is a very big problem. You go to local bookstores, philosophy books are hard to find. The bookshelf for philosophy books is literally smaller than my bookshelf behind me here. You don't find a lot of philosophical texts. anywhere in public. They're hard to find online unless you already know what you're looking for. And additionally, none of our guys who are part of our movement seem to be printing works that are Western philosophy. I want more of that. I want people printing Nietzsche books. I want us to be buying a Nietzsche book from somebody that's ideologically aligned with us, not from, you know, Barnes and Nobles or Amazon or something of the sort. I want to buy it from our guys, so we're supporting our guys in our endeavor to learn about our history. I think that's the appropriate way that it should be done. So that's the schedule for next week. Week after, I'll give you guys that when we get a little bit closer. I just will say that, again, the Ursula Haverback Memorial Show has been pushed back to that week, as well as I will be talking to Ian Malcolm. I'll be having him on the show that week as well, so you guys can look forward to that. That's the schedule. That's all we've got going on for the next week or so. Might consider doing some weekend shows next week. Haven't done a weekend show in a little bit, so we'll see if we're going to be doing that. Not exactly sure about that. Sheetenhood. Okay, I'm very sorry. Yeah, I'm not good with our cultural languages yet. I got a lot to learn about language and pronunciations, especially Norwegian or Swedish or Danish. I've absolutely not a clue how to pronounce words that are in that category. So, all right. And with that being said, let's get into the show, because I do want to make sure we finish chapter one today. If we finish it a little bit early, we'll end the show early. Just a friendly reminder, folks. We are going to be reading the Stalag edition of Mein Kampf. So if you guys want to follow along, if you want to read the book with me, if you want to pull up an online PDF as we're reading so you can physically look at the text while we analyze it, I really recommend that you do that. It's a lot easier to study that way. I would recommend you do that. You can find, just go on Brave Browser and look up Mein Kampf Stalag edition PDF. It'll come up there. If it doesn't come up, or if you're a person that wants to get a physical copy, and I always highly recommend you get a physical copy. It's a lot different if you are opening up the book and I'm reading it and you're reading along with me, and you actually can underline some things of serious importance, or you can, you know, chart some things down, put a little note on one of the paragraphs on the side. Again, my book looks like that, you know, everywhere. If you look at my book, you can see I've got underlines all over the place. I've got, you know, brackets on the side. A lot of pages will have just notes throughout them periodically on the side, wherever, you know, something comes to mind, or it kind of draws a connection to something else that I've read or thought of. Like if you see this page, I've gone a little bit crazy on that page, right? I got a lot of pages dog-eared. This book has been used and abused, that's for sure. So if you guys do want to get a physical copy, again, you can get a physical copy at moneytreepublishing.com. All one word, moneytreepublishing.com. They have physical copies on there. When you sign out and you go to purchase the book, use code LOGOS, L-O-G-O-S, okay? And you're going to save yourself 10% on the purchase, so it makes it a little bit easier for you. I get a small royalty for that, so you're supporting me, you're supporting yourself by getting yourself this book and really educating. I'm telling you, I cannot express how important this book is to read and study. And then additionally, you're supporting one of our guys who owns the website, who also owns FTJ Media and has been trying to push a free speech platform out there as well. So again, more of that community-based purchases going through a middleman that actually cares about us and is working for our interests rather than, you know, some Jewish conglomerate corporation or something of the sort. Bob, that sounds good. Yeah, certainly. You can always send me a message on Telegram. My Telegram is Logos Revealed. Again, you can send me an email. It's logosrevealed88@gmail.com. Just understand that you're probably gonna wait a little bit for a response on the email. It happens for like everybody, so do not take it personally. Before we start, I do want to read the back of the Stalag edition. This will really hammer home why the Stalag edition is important to read over any of the other editions. Again, you can read the Thomas Dalton edition. That's a good edition as well. I personally recommend the Stalag specifically because it's the only translation that was officially authorized by the NSDAP themselves. Thomas Dalton obviously is ideologically aligned. He's one of our guys, so he's not putting anything subversive in the work. But I do like that real authentic version, you know, the original source. I'm a fan of something like that, so you're welcome to pick whichever one you would like, Thomas Dalton or Stalag. But just please make sure that you don't read the Mannheim, Murphy, or Ford translations. They're just not as good. So I'm going to read the back of this, and this will kind of explain why. Okay, so this is the only complete, unabridged, and officially authorized English translation ever issued by the National Socialist Party, and is not to be confused with any other versions. Translated by an unknown English-speaking National Socialist Party member, it was printed by the Franz Air Verlag in Berlin for the Central Press of the NSDAP in limited numbers during the years 1937 to 1944. Most copies were distributed to the camp libraries of English-speaking POW camps, or prisoner of war camps, and became known as the Stalag editions, Stalag being a contraction of the German word Stammlager, or POW camp, because they all carried a camp library rubber stamp on the title page. And you can see that stamp right here, right there. That's the stamp that's being discussed. Only a handful of copies survived the war, and the text contained in this edition has been taken directly, without amendment, from one of these extremely rare editions. Now, the without amendment part is very important to understand, because that's very rare with this book, right? Even if you pick up, like, I believe it's the Mannheim version, there's like a preface by the ADL about how hate-filled the book is, right? This official translation is not to be confused with the James Murphy or Ralph Mannheim translations, both of which were edited, abridged, and ultimately unauthorized. The Murphy and Mannheim editions both left out major sections of text and contained long, clunky, badly translated, and almost unintelligibly long sentences. In sharp contrast, the only authorized Stalag edition contains none of these complicated and unnecessarily confused constructions and is extremely easy to read, as anyone familiar with the other versions will immediately notice. Most importantly, this only authorized edition contains the full text of the original German and none of the deliberately inserted racial pejoratives used in the Murphy and Mannheim versions, words of which Hitler never actually used in the original. So again, making him look as crazy as they possibly can. Contrary to post-war propaganda, Mein Kampf does not contain a plan for world domination, and instead consists of a short autobiography, the effect of the First World War upon Germany, a discussion of race and the Jewish problem, the constitutional and social makeup of a future German state, and the early struggles of the NSDAP up until 1923. Okay, so that is why the Stalag edition is the most important. That's why I really recommend that people read that version over any other. And for those asking, Stalag is spelled Stalag. That is the English variant. I'm sure it's probably spelled different in German. I also want to start with the author's preface. I think this preface is wonderful and very important. I want you also to remember that Hitler formulated this book while he was essentially a political prisoner for the Beer Hall Putsch, which was a small attempt at a push for power, and he was put in the Landsberg. Can't remember the full name of it, but he was imprisoned in Landsberg. Okay, so this is the author's preface, very short and sweet. He says, "On April 1st, 1924, I began to serve my sentence of detention in the fortress of Landsberg am Lech, following the verdict pronounced by the Munich People's Court on that day. After years of uninterrupted labor, it was now possible for the first time to begin a work for which many had asked and which I myself felt would be profitable for the movement. I therefore decided to devote two volumes to a description not only of the aims of our movement, but also of its development. There is more to be learned from this than from any purely doctrinaire treatise. This has also given me the opportunity of describing my own development, insofar as such a description is necessary, to the understanding of the first, as well as the second volume, and to refute the unfounded tales which the Jewish press has circulated about me. Mind you, this is in 1924. This is 9 years before he is in power. He's talking about the Jewish press spinning lies about him. In this work, I turn not to strangers, but to those followers of the movement whose hearts belong to it and who wish to study it more profoundly. I know that fewer people are won over by the written than the spoken word, and that every great movement on this earth owes its growth to great speakers and not to great writers. Nevertheless, in order to achieve more equality and uniformity in the defense of any doctrine, its fundamental principles must be committed to writing. May these two volumes therefore serve as building stones, which I contribute to the common task. The Fortress Landsberg am Lech. So, again, the fact that he needs to preface that the Jewish press is creating stories and fomenting lies about him all the way back on April 1st, 1924, is quite something, right? It's very interesting to know that they were already spinning things about a man that was not in power, was not, you know, widely known by society yet at this point. He was probably working his way up there, but he was not yet very well known. So just for the sake of simplicity and kind of keeping this short for the audience, I will read the next part. We're not going to read all of the names that are laid out, but I will read the piece here. He states, at 12:30 on the afternoon of November 9th, 1923, those whose names are given below fell in front of the Feldner Hall and in the forecourt of the former war ministry in Munich as loyal believers in the resurrection of their people. These men were fighting on behalf of the National Socialist Party. And they were they unfortunately lost their lives in one of these scuffles. So there are a lot of names listed out here. I'm not going to read all of those names just for the sake of simplicity. But he is essentially paying homage to these men in the very beginning of the book, expressing his gratitude for them helping with the movement. He states, the so-called national authorities refuse to allow the dead heroes a common grave. I therefore dedicate to them the first volume of this work as a common memorial in order that they, as martyrs to the cause, may be a permanent inspiration to the followers of our movement. That's a very very kind gesture. Okay, so we're going to start here with chapter one. For those following along, chapter one of the Stalag edition of Mein Kampf, entitled My Home. This chapter is about 14 pages. We're going to do our best to push through this all on today's episode. And again, I will give commentary and analysis where I think it's necessary. There's not going to be a crazy amount of commentary in the first chapter just because of the nature of it. It's more him explaining his childhood and his history and kind of where he comes from, which, you know, there's not too much to analyze in that, but there's a little bit. So we'll certainly be pausing from time to time. Let me actually take my overcoat off. I'm getting a little bit warm. Yeah, certainly. I do agree with you, Rusty. They're going to get comfortable with it over time. It's a process, right? Okay, so chapter one. Today, I consider it a good omen that destiny appointed Bernau-on-the-Inn to be my birthplace. For that little town is situated just on the frontier between those two German states, the reunion of which seems, at least to us of the younger generation, a task to which we should devote our lives, and in the pursuit of which every possible means should be employed. So for those not familiar what he's referencing here, if you're not familiar with the geography of the time, this is Germany and Austria that he is referring to, and these two states were obviously separated, and he aimed to, when he came to power, Hitler aimed to break down the Treaty of Versailles and reunite these two bodies under one governmental system, right? And that was one of the first things that he actually achieved when he came to power. So continuing. German Austria must be restored to the greater German fatherland, and not on economic grounds. Even if the Union were a matter of economic indifference, and even if it were to be disadvantageous from the economic standpoint, it still ought to take place. People of the same blood should be in the same Reich. The German people will have no right to engage in a colonial policy until they have brought all their children together in one state. When the territory of the Reich embraces all Germans and proves incapable of assuring them a livelihood, only then can the moral right arise from the need of the people to acquire foreign territory. The plow is then the sword, and the tears of war will produce the daily bread for the generations to come. So, again, I want to preface here, because this is where they get this idea of world dominion, right? This is where the media kind of spins this narrative. What he's stating is, if you're living in a state, and that state is no longer able to sustain itself because it has so many people, again, all of the same buildup, the same genetic background, and all of these people are overcrowding the area. You have a lack of ability to maintain crops and soil for these people. Only then is it morally justifiable for expansion, is what he's stating. Now, you also have to remember geography in this circumstance. Think about how Britain expanded all over the world, right, because they needed to continuously pick up land in order to create landmass for their people. You know, in America here, we have a little bit of a different circumstance. So, you know, when you hear about this, you think, oh, well, it doesn't really make sense for us to ever need a land grab. Like, why would that ever be a thing that's even, you know, thought of? Well, the reason is, you know, Germany is the size of Texas, and it's all these other countries are surrounding it in this little area of Europe, right? So we have to think about the geography. It's a very important piece to understand here, is that, you know, in America or Canada, these are issues that really we don't have to think about geographical issues in this matter, at least. So please do understand that, you know, the circumstance of the time and the geographical situation that they are in. For this reason, the little frontier town appeared to me as the symbol of a great task. But in another respect, it teaches us a lesson that is applicable to our day. Over 100 years ago, this sequestered spot was a scene of a tragic calamity, which affected the whole German nation and will be remembered forever, at least in the annals of German history. At the time of our fatherland's deepest humiliation, a Nuremberg bookseller, Johannes Palm, an uncompromising nationalist and an enemy of the French, was put to death here because he had loved Germany even in her misfortune. He obstinately refused to disclose the names of his associates, or rather, the principals who were chiefly responsible for the affair, just as Leo Schlageter did. The former, like the latter, was denounced to the French by a government official, a director of police from Augsburg, who won ignoble renown on that occasion and set the example, which was to be copied at a later date by the German officials of the Reich under Herr Severing's regime. In this little town on the Inn, hallowed by the memory of a German martyr, a town that was Bavarian by blood, but under the rule of the Austrian state, my parents were domiciled towards the end of the last century. My father was a civil servant who fulfilled his duties very conscientiously. My mother looked after the household and lovingly devoted herself to the care of her children. Of that period, I have not retained many memories, because after a few years, my father had to leave that frontier town, which I had come to love so much, and take up a new post farther down the Inn Valley at Passau, therefore actually in Germany itself. In those days, it was the usual lot of an Austrian civil servant to be transferred periodically from one post to another. Not long after coming to Passau, my father was transferred to Linz, and while there, he retired to live on his pension, but this did not mean that the old gentleman would now rest from his labors. He was the son of a poor cottager, and while still a boy, he grew restless and left home. When he was barely 13 years old, he buckled on his satchel and set forth from his native country parish. Despite the dissuasion of villagers who could speak from experience, he went to Vienna to learn a trade there. This was in the 50s of last century. It was a sore trial, that of deciding to leave home and face the unknown. With 3 gulden in his pocket, but when the boy of 13 was a lad of 17 and had passed his apprenticeship examination as a craftsman, he was not content. On the contrary, the persistent economic depression of that period and the constant want and misery strengthened his resolution to give up working at a trade and strive for something higher. As a boy, it had seemed to him that the position of the parish priest in his native village was the highest in the scale of human attainment. But now that the big city had enlarged his outlook, the young man looked up to the dignity of a state official as the highest of all. With the tenacity of one whom misery and trouble had already made old when only halfway through his youth, the young man of 17 obstinately set out on his new project and stuck to it until he won through. He became a civil servant. He was about 23 years old, I believe, when he succeeded in making himself what he had resolved to become. Thus he was able to keep the vow he had made as a poor boy, not to return to his native village until he was somebody. He had gained his end, but in the village there was nobody who remembered him as a little boy, and the village itself had become strange to him. Now at last, when he was 56 years old, he gave up his active career, but he could not bear to be idle for a single day. On the outskirts of the small market town of Lambach, in Upper Austria, he bought a farm and tilled it himself. Thus, at the end of a long and hard-working career, he returned to the life which his father had led. It was at this period that I first began to have ideals of my own. I spent a good deal of time, scampering about in the open, on the long road from school, and mixing with some of the roughest of the boys, which caused my mother many anxious moments. All this tended to make me something quite the reverse of a stay-at-home. I think that that's an important piece that he's describing, is his extroverted nature, right? Which is very required leadership trait for somebody to have. I gave scarcely any serious thought to the question of choosing a vocation in life, but I was certainly quite out of sympathy with the kind of career which my father had followed. I think that an inborn talent for speaking now began to develop and take shape during the more or less strenuous arguments which I used to have with my comrades. I had become a juvenile ringleader who learned well and easy at school, but was rather difficult to manage. In my free time, I practiced singing in the choir of the monastery church at Lambach, and thus it happened that I was placed in a very favorable position to be emotionally impressed again and again by the magnificent splendor of excelsior ceremonial. What could be more natural for me than to look upon the abbot as representing the highest human ideal worth striving for, just as the position of the humble village priest had appeared so to my father in his own boyhood days. At last, that was my ideal for a while, but the childish disputes I had with my father did not lead him to appreciate his son's oratorical gift in such a way as to see them a favorable promise for such a career. And so, he naturally could not understand the boyish ideas I had in my head at that time. This contradiction in my character made him feel somewhat anxious. As a matter of fact, that transitory yearning after such a vocation soon gave way to hopes that were better suited to my temperament. browsing among my father's books, I chanced to come across some publications that dealt with military subjects. One of these publications was a popular history of the Franco-German War of 1870 to 71. It consisted of two volumes of art, illustrated periodical dating from those years. These became my favorite reading. In a little while, that great and heroic conflict began to occupy my mind. And from that time onwards, I became more and more enthusiastic about everything that was in any way connected with war or military affairs. The story of the Franco-German War had a special significance for me on other grounds also. For the first time, and as yet only in quite a vague way, the question began to present itself. Is there a difference, and if there be, what is it, between the Germans who fought that war and the other Germans? Why did not Austria also take part in it? Why did not my father and all the others fight in that struggle? Are we not the same as the other Germans? Do we not all belong together? That was the first time this problem began to agitate my small brain. And from the replies that were given to the questions which I asked very tentatively, I was forced to accept the fact, though with a secret envy, that not all Germans had the good luck to belong to Bismarck's Reich. This was something that I could not understand. So he's describing this issue of, again, the split between Germany and Austria, and why are they not connected, right? They're biologically connected. They're the same peoples. They have the same history and ancestry, but they're split between two political entities. So he's asking himself, why is that the case, right? This is a true kind of nationalistic yearning, right? And he'll go into nationalism a little bit, so I won't go too deep on that point. But there is something very important to hammer home there. We'll wait until he goes a little bit further on this. Okay. Continuing. It was decided that I should study. Considering my character as a whole, and especially my temperament, my father decided that the classical subjects studied at the gymnasium were not suited to my natural talents. He thought that the Realschule would suit me better. Now, this is important. If you don't understand how schooling works in Germany, and I believe this is the case, correct me if I'm wrong, but they don't have like a elementary, middle, and high school in the same fashion that we do. They have essentially an elementary school that they go to from like grade 1 to 6. They spend their time there. And then after that, they're meant to pick in between two different schools, right? I don't recall if it's the parents that pick this. I believe it's just the parents that pick this. And they either go to the Realschule, which is more of like an arts school, arts and culture kind of a thing, or they go to the Gymnasium, which is more of this like labor-based, almost like a trade school kind of, like if you go to college in the United States, you can go to like regular college courses and stuff, and then you can also go to a trade school where you learn a trade, like you can go and learn, woodworking or engineering or something of the sort. So that's how it works in Germany. Only reason I actually know that is because I took German in school from my first 2 years of high school. I took German. I wish I went every year because I really do look back and wish I learned the German language. I've always had a deep interest in all things German, which would make sense. It's part of my background. My obvious talent for drawing confirmed him in that view, for in his opinion, drawing was a subject too much neglected in the Austrian gymnasium. Probably also the memory of the hard road which he himself had traveled contributed to make him look upon classical studies as unpractical and accordingly to set little value on them. At the back of his mind, he had the idea that his son should also become a government official. Indeed, he had decided on that career for me. The difficulties with which he had had to contend in making his own career led him to overestimate what he had achieved, because this was exclusively the result of his own indefatigable industry and energy. The characteristic pride of the self-made man caused him to cherish the idea that his son should follow the same calling, and if possible, rise to a higher position in it. Moreover, this idea was strengthened by the consideration that the result of his own life's industry had placed him in a position to facilitate his son's advancement in the same profession. And this is is actually kind of interesting, because it's very relatable for any of those that have a boomer father that grew up, you know, a manual laborer. We've always heard this term in America: pick yourself up by the bootstraps, son, right? I worked, I did it, you should do it too, you know, which is, again, it's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's exactly this. It's the self-made man looking at his achievements and then overestimating them and thinking that everyone should be capable of the same. And we have to remember as well the economic circumstance we're in the United States. It's not like it was all of those years ago where you could get any job. You could get a job as like an engineer back then without a college degree. That's not the case now. You have to go to college for these things. You have to be well studied. And then if you're white, you know, you're lucky if you even get a spot, because they got to meet all their racial quotas. They have to meet their gender quotas. And then, you know, the white guy gets to be looked at on the list of applications after the fact, right? You're the afterthought. So it's a little bit of a difficult situation, but this is very common mindset. This is kind of a natural development, and we see this directly in the boomer generation, who has a lot of the conservative types have that mindset of pick yourself up by the bootstraps, which the concept that they're you know, enumerating, that we should be working hard, we should really be struggling and toiling, that concept is good, and that's an agreeable concept, and it's a good conviction to have. But they have to, you know, take into account the circumstances of the time. And obviously, coming from the younger generation, it could obviously seem like a laziness excuse, like, oh, I don't want to work, so I just say it's harder. But there really is a lot of difficulties for us to analyze differences in the circumstance that we have compared to what was existent in America 50 or 60 years ago. He was simply incapable of imagining that I might reject what had meant everything in life to him. My father's decision was simple, definite, clear, and in his eyes, it was something to be taken for granted. A man of such a nature, who had become an autocrat by reason of his own hard struggle for existence, could not think of allowing inexperienced and irresponsible young people to choose their own careers. To act in such a way, where the future of his own son was concerned, would have been a grave and reprehensible weakness in the exercise of parental authority and responsibility, something utterly incompatible with his characteristic sense of duty. Still, he did not have his way. For the first time in my life, I was then 11 years old, I felt myself forced into open opposition. No matter how hard and determined my father might be about putting his own plans and opinions into effect, his son was no less obstinate in refusing to accept ideas on which he set little or no value. I would not become a civil servant. And I always think this is a really important line. You know, this seems like a very simple line, but this is the sign of an independent individual, someone who thinks for themselves. This is a very revolutionary mindset. You know, you cannot just tell me what job field to go into and I will accept it from authority. You know, it's got to come from my own heart, my own place. This is something I definitely dealt with a lot as a child. As a personal example for myself, high school was very much a difficult thing for me, because we would go to school and 50% of my grade in high school was homework, like 20% was classwork, and like 30% was testing. And I would get A's and A's and A's on my tests, and I would do most of my classwork. But homework, well, what's the purpose of homework? Homework is, it's extra work that you're taking home to double study. It's like a double study of the subject to really make sure that you got it down pat. Well, if I'm getting A's on my tests and I'm showing that I have the intelligence, isn't that all that matters, right? The whole point in testing you is to see if you know the information. The point in forcing you to do homework, even if you already know the information, now it's boiling down to obedience. And this is something I struggled with, because I would constantly say to family, and they would, you know, be upset with me because my grades were slacking. I was getting D's and F's in a lot of classes because I just simply wouldn't do the homework. And they would be upset with me, and I would try to explain to them, this doesn't make sense to me. I'm getting A's on the test. I know the stuff. They're teaching me it. I understand it. I'm retaining it. I don't need the extra nonsense. I don't need the filler. So I relate with this passage and what he's experiencing here, maybe in a little bit of a different way, but it's a very relatable feeling of spirit. You know, I won't just accept something that I can't, that doesn't make sense to me, that doesn't seem to have value in my eyes. Continuing. No amount of persuasion and no amount of grave warnings could break down that opposition. I would not become a government official. Not on my account. All the attempts which my father made to arouse in me a love or liking for that profession by picturing his own career for me had only the opposite effect. It nauseated me to think that one day I might be fettered to an office stool, that I could not dispose of my own time, but would be forced to spend the whole of my life filling out forms. One can imagine what kind of thoughts such a prospect awakened in the mind of a boy who is by no means what is called a good boy in the current sense of that term. The ease with which I learned my lessons made it possible for me to spend far more time in the open air than at home. So again, another very important piece here, right? This is an individual who didn't want to be in public office. He didn't want to be a government official. Then he becomes, you know, this revolutionary leader for his country. So again, if the theory is that he was a madman who wanted world dominion, if that was the mindset, right, of this individual, wouldn't that be a thing from the very beginning, that you would want to seek power through governmental office in order to get your world dominion? No, he didn't come to that conclusion through later life because of the ills of society he saw around him. He said, wow, somebody needs to fix this, and I think I'm suited for the job. It's a very important next paragraph here. I really recommend, if you are reading along, you underline this next paragraph. This one's very key. Today, when my political opponents pry into my life as far back as the days of my boyhood, with diligent scrutiny, so as to finally be able to prove what disreputable tricks this Hitler was accustomed to play in his young day, I thank heaven that I can look back on those happy days and find the memory of them helpful. The fields and the woods were then the terrain on which all disputes were fought out. Even attendance at the Realschule could not alter my way of spending my time. But I had now another battle to fight. So long as the paternal plan to make me a state functionary contradicted my own inclinations only in the abstract, the conflict was easy to bear. I could be discreet about expressing my personal views, and thus avoid constantly recurrent disputes. My own resolution not to become a government official was sufficient for the time being to put my mind completely at rest. I held on to that resolution inexorably, but the situation became more difficult once I had a positive plan of my own, which I could present to my father as a counter-suggestion. This happened when I was 12 years old. How it came about, I cannot exactly say now, but one day it became clear to me that I wanted to be a painter. I mean, an artist. That I had an aptitude for drawing was an admitted fact. It was even one of the reasons why my father had sent me to the Realschule. But he had never thought of having that talent developed so that I could take up painting as a professional career. Quite the contrary. When, as a result of my renewed refusal to comply with his favorite plan, my father asked me for the first time what I myself really wished to be, the resolution that I had already formed expressed itself almost automatically. For a while, my father was speechless. "A painter? An artist?" he exclaimed. He wondered whether I was in a sound state of mind. He thought that he might not have caught my words rightly, or that he had misunderstood what I meant. But when I explained my ideas to him, and he saw how seriously I took them, he opposed them with his characteristic energy. His decision was exceedingly simple, and could not be deflected from its course by any consideration of what my own natural qualifications really were. "Artist? Not as long as I live, never." As the son had inherited some of his father's obstinacy, along with other qualities, his reply was equally energetic, but of course opposed to his, and so the matter stood. My father would not abandon his never, and I became all the more determined in my nevertheless. Naturally, the resulting situation was not pleasant. The old gentleman was embittered, and indeed so was I, although I really loved him. My father forbade me to entertain any hopes of taking up painting as a profession. I went a step further and declared that I would not study anything else. With such declarations, the situation became still more strained, so that the old gentleman decided to assert his parental authority at all costs. This led me to take refuge in silence. But I put my threat into execution. I thought that, once it became clear to my father that I was making no progress at the real Schule, he would be forced to allow me to follow the career I had dreamed of. I do not know whether I calculated rightly or not. Certainly my failure to make progress became apparent in the school. I studied just those subjects that appealed to me, especially those which I thought might be of advantage to me later on as a painter. What did not appear to have any importance from this point of view, or what did not otherwise appeal to me, I completely neglected. And I think that's a really important piece as well. Again, it shows that same independent revolutionary nature, right? Of, you know, going to school, and this is, I've talked about this actually probably this exact piece when we were reading this book before on my show. But one thing that really struck me when I was in high school that still to this day angers me is it was mandatory that we had to take two art classes in order to graduate high school. You had to have two art credits, okay? So you physically had to learn art. Even if it's something that you're not inclined to or not interested in, you had to take like a painting class or a pottery class or something of the sort. And at the same time, PFM, Personal Finance Management, was an elective class that was not required. So your system is teaching you that you are required to learn how to paint and color and draw, but you're not required to learn how to write a check, open up a loan, create a bank account, use a credit card, get a bank account set up with you know, low interest rates. These are all things that, well, that's not required to be taught to graduate. Yet you're required to take a pottery class or some form of art. That to me didn't make any sense, right? The things that really will matter to every citizen, every single person needs to know how to manage their personal finances. Everybody, without exception, it's a necessity. But not every single person needs to understand art. Some people are not artistically inclined. Some people just aren't interested in it, right? It's still good to know, and maybe even one art class being a mandatory thing is a good idea. But personal finance management should be mandatory. It shouldn't be, you know, up for interpretation. Continuing. My school reports of that time were always in the extremes of good or bad, according to the subject and the interest it had for me. In one column, the remark was very good or excellent. In another, average, below average. By far, my best subjects were geography and general history. excuse me. Excuse me. These were my two favorite subjects, and I was top of the class in them. When I look back over so many years and try to judge the results of that experience, I find two very significant facts standing out clearly before my mind. Firstly, I became a nationalist. Secondly, I learned to understand and grasp the true meaning of history. The old Austria was a multinational state. In those days, at least, the citizens of the Reich, taken all in all, could not understand what that fact meant in the everyday life of the individuals within such a state. So now this is really important. There's two pieces in here that are very important. His explanation of nationalism, why nationalism is important. And he will go further into this, I believe, later. But we've talked about this on the show quite a few times. This is the difference between nationalism and patriotism, right? You will get some disgusting human piece of flotsam, like Charlie Kirk, who says, oh, well, I'm an American patriot. Okay? Well, what's a patriot? A patriot is one who loves his country. Well, what's a nationalist? A nationalist is somebody who loves their nation. Okay? So that includes the country, but it includes nation. If you read the actual definition of the word nation, race is included in that definition. So a nationalist is someone who loves not only their country, but the people who made that country. So Hitler's not saying, oh, I love Germany. He's saying, I love Germany and the German people who created it. That is what I love above anything. Okay? And then secondly, the second thing that's very important here is looking at his old Austria. He says it's a multinational state. Now, mind you, Hitler in Vienna and old, you know, Austria, in these circumstances, he's talking about, you know, we've got a couple Russians in here and a couple Brits and some Frenchmen that are inside of my German state, right? He's seeing that as a problem. Okay, now he's talking about conglomerated European peoples in one state causing disruption in the political body. Now imagine fundamentally different peoples all pushed together into a state, much like the American melting pot. How much tension that causes upon society. Completely different, right? Because these cultures are so fundamentally different. Again, we've used the example of Indians and this praise of the cow, right? If that was to come into America, come into a political position of power, and they were to pass a law against the slaughter of cows because it's something that they find holy, imagine how much that would change the structure of America overnight, right? Burger shops would shut down, the farms, they would be in very dire straits, the butchers that have been doing this for years, they would go out of business, all of these factories. I mean, a whole industry would collapse overnight because a different culture and a different peoples took power, right? And now when you look at the collective European peoples, they have some differences in cultures, certainly in foods and traditions. But one thing that's key is the European soul is very similar. So if you go to these different European countries, their morality systems, their values are very similar. They might have different languages and traditions and things like that, but their values and their morals are very, very similar. And this comes if you go and look at the Asiatics as an example. They have differences in culture. The Japanese, the Koreans, the Chinese, the Vietnamese, they all have their different cultures, their languages, their, you know, whatever they have. But they're very similar when it comes to their value systems. Their morality is very similar. And it's the same if you look at Africa. It's the exact same circumstance, right? All of the blacks in Africa, sure, you can be from Zimbabwe or the Congo, right? But no matter where you're from, they have similar cultures, right? Now, it's harder to look at Africa as an example because they don't have a lot of, like, architecture or philosophy to draw off of in order to make these comparisons. So when you look at the collective European and Asiatic peoples, those are the two categories that you can really analyze something like this quite well. Continuing further. After the magnificent triumphant march of the victorious armies in the Franco-German War, the Germans in the Reich became steadily more and more estranged from the Germans beyond their frontiers, partly because they did not deign to appreciate those other Germans at their true value, or simply because they were incapable of doing so. In thinking of Austria, they were prone to confuse the decadent dynasty and the people, which was essentially very sound. Now, this is really important, right? He's saying, look, you know, if you're thinking about the state, so for instance, that would be like us right now in America going, Canada, oh, that Trudeau asshole, Canada's a shithole. Oh, that's a terrible place. I don't like Canadians. Well, that doesn't, the Canadian people have nothing to do with Trudeau or the governmental system, which absolutely does suck ass, right? Just like Australia, the governmental system sucks ass. But that doesn't mean that the people themselves are terrible. And it's very important that he's pulling that aspect aside. He's saying, look, you know, the Germans that were in Austria, sure, like the Germans in Germany might have had a distaste for the Austrian state, but they still should have loved those German people because they weren't to blame for the circumstance, right? They were a victim of the circumstance. The Germans in the Reich did not realize that if the Germans in Austria had not been of the best racial stock, they could never have given the stamp of their own character to an empire of 52 millions. So definitely that in Germany itself, the idea arose, though quite erroneously, that Austria was a German state. That was an error which had dire consequences. But all the same, it was a magnificent testimony to the character of the 10 million Germans in the Ostmark. Only very few Germans in the Reich itself had an idea of the bitter struggle which those Eastern Germans had to carry on daily for the preservation of their German language, their German schools, and their German character. Only today, and by the way, I want to point on this as well, this is also very important. Think about in America, this is accelerated from your German character being attacked or your Irish character being attacked, and it's hard to keep that tradition alive. Now it's your white character. It's the collective Aryan character. They're doing everything in their power to seed that white racial consciousness out of the people. And it's the same thing they were doing that he's describing right here. This is a microscopic scale, what he's describing. We are now on the macro scale. We're seeing a global displacement of our peoples culturally, okay? And actually physically, right? They're trying to literally physically extinct us through birth control and these other avenues as well. But culturally, they are trying to destroy any essence of what is called white pride, right? And if you don't believe that, if you think that's a hyperbolic statement, I challenge you right now, go to the ADL's website, go into their hate category, and go look at their hate symbols. And one of their hate symbols is, and I quote, "It's okay to be white." That is a hate symbol on the ADL's hate database. Okay, so if you don't believe that they're trying to break down your ethnic character and your cultural background, that's a very good example of it, with many more to follow. Only today, when a tragic fate has wrested several millions of our kinsfolk from the Reich and has forced them to live under the rule of the stranger, dreaming of that common fatherland towards which all their yearnings are directed, and struggling to uphold at least the sacred right of using their mother tongue. Only now have the wider circles of the German population come to realize what it means to have to fight for the traditions of one's race. And I also want to enumerate that this is a problem in the very mixed areas in the United States. Ooh, holy smokes, that was a big one. Whew, that actually kind of hurt. So you can see this exemplified in the inner city ghettos that have become majority black, like 80, 90% black. White kids that grow up in that area, what happens to them? What happens? They typically come out as they're using these like thick Ebonics. They have this Uyghur culture where they're dressing with the pants off the ass and they got the chains and they talk like they're, you know, straight out of a rap video. And, oh, shit, man. Oh, shit. You know, you tell them, dog. Right? They talk like that. They listen to this music. And why? Because it's the only way to fit in. If they would hold their actual character, their actual racial character, they would be outcasted. Most of them would probably be beat to a pulp for being a white devil. So that's one example. Again, this is we're speaking micro examples of a much larger problem. God damn. Excuse me. I see we got a Brain DeShazer, if I'm saying that right. Subscribing to Loyals on the Stu Peters Network. Thank you for supporting Stu. I appreciate that on his behalf. So at last, perhaps there are people here and there who can assess the greatness of that German spirit which animated the old Ostmark and enabled those people, left entirely dependent on their own resources, to defend the Reich against the Orient for several centuries, and subsequently to hold the frontiers of the German language by means of a guerrilla warfare of attrition. At a time when the German Reich was sedulously cultivating an interest in colonies, but not in its own flesh and blood at its very threshold. What has happened always and everywhere, in every kind of struggle, happened also in the language fight, which was carried on in the old Austria. Now, this next line, if you guys are following along, if you have your own physical copy, I want you to, like highlight, sharpie, underline this next line. This next line is extremely important for the analysis of human nature, because it's this, you can't argue outside of this framework. It's a really important line. He states, there were three groups of fighters. Those who were... Am I on drugs? What's happening here? Am I not reading this correctly? He says, there were three groups of fighters. Those who were lukewarm... Oh, I'm sorry. I am reading it wrong. Okay, there were three groups. My apologies. The fighters, those who were lukewarm, and the traitors. I don't know why I was reading that so oddly. This is a really important piece, because this is present today. You see this everywhere. You have the fighters that are willing to put their face on a screen and discuss this problem, and go super out of their way to talk about the Jewish problem. You've got the lukewarm that are, I'm not interested. All we can do is vote for Trump in November. Hopefully he'll fix it, right? That's the lukewarm mindset. And then you have the traitors, which are the people that they're intelligent enough to know what this problem is, but they're too cowardly to speak on it. Jordan Peterson, Charlie Kirk, these characters, these are the traitors, right? Traitors to their country and their people and their nation, one and the same. This sifting process began even in the schools, and it is worth being noted that the struggle for the language was waged perhaps in its bitterest form around the school, because this was the nursery where the seeds had to be tended, which were to spring up and form the future generation. The tactical objective of the fight was the winning over of the child, and it was to the child that the first rallying cry was addressed. German boy, do not forget that you are a German. And remember, little girl, that one day you must be a German mother. Those who know something of the juvenile spirit can understand how youth will always lend a ready ear to such a rallying cry. In many ways, the young people led the struggle, fighting in their own manner and with their own weapons. They refused to sing non-German songs. Right? It's a good one. It's really good. So we should be refusing to sing Jewish songs. So next time you're somewhere and they're singing God Bless America, say, not interested. Not interested. Let's go back, let's sing the Founding Fathers songs that they created, right? Don't sing these Jewish-made songs. Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, right? These songs which are pushing different traditions, different cultures, different spirit upon the people. The greater the efforts made to win them away from their German allegiance, the more they exalted the glory of their German heroes. They stinted themselves in buying sweet meats so that they might spare their pennies to help the war fund of their elders. They were incredibly alert to the significance of what the non-German teachers said, and they contradicted in unison. They wore the forbidden emblems of their own nation, and were happy when penalized, or even physically punished. In their own way, they faithfully mirrored their elders, and often their attitude was finer and more sincere. And again, this is really important too, analyzing why the youth is so good at this, standing up for what is right, what is natural to them. The youth doesn't have that social conditioning. Okay, this is why when you go somewhere, like a little child will look at a fat person and they'll go, "Oh, she's fat, mom, she's fat." Right? That's something that adults don't do, because we've been trained that it's socially unsound to do something like that. Well, actually, it's actually very natural, intrinsic, when you see somebody that's overweight to be repulsed by this, because it's not natural. They're unhealthy. Their offspring are going to be unhealthy. And it's, by the way, it's a sign of that person's level of discipline. When you see somebody that's morbidly obese, it's not much different from seeing somebody that's a heroin junkie. These are people without discipline, and you can see that on them. So naturally, you don't have respect for them because you know they can't be trusted with things. So it might just be that they can't be trusted with food, but nonetheless, they can't be trusted. Their discipline is lacking. So it's a natural instinct to look at somebody who's morbidly obese and go, ooh. You know, if they can't take care of themselves and what they're shoveling into their mouth, how are they going to take care of their children? And this is why, more times than not, people that are morbidly obese, their children are morbidly obese. It's not only because it's genetic. I'll give you the best story from a personal perspective. When I was in school, in elementary school, all the way growing up to high school, I had a kid in my school. His name was Tyler. He was massive. Massive. His parents were massive. I'm talking 400-pound parents. And he himself, in elementary school, was already, you know, like 180. Massive kid. And this kid, every day in the lunchroom, there was Oreos in his lunch. There was, you know, marshmallows, and it was just junk. It was always just his whole lunch was full of junk. There was never a healthy thing in it. I'm not kidding you. 2 years after I graduated high school, that kid died of a heart attack. He was like 23. He died of a heart attack. Well, maybe even younger. Because 2 years after, he had to be like 19 or 20. And he died of a heart attack. That's insane. That's disgusting. To be dying of a heart attack at 19 or 20. That's a big problem. That's a huge problem. And now, when you're a kid, in his shoes, it's hard for him to control that. Like, if your parents are morbidly obese cows and they're just shoveling shit into you, you just kind of grow up with that and it's natural to you, right? You don't realize that, like, oh, wait, like, maybe I shouldn't be eating like this. Maybe I shouldn't be this size, right? It's unfortunate for the child. But his parents are deeply to blame on this. Continuing. Thus it was that at a comparatively early age, I took part in the struggle which the nationalities were waging against one another in the old Austria. When collections were made for the Youth Mark German League and the School League, we wore cornflowers and black, red, gold colors to express our loyalty. We greeted one another with Heil. And instead of the Austrian anthem, we sang our own, Deutschland über alles, despite warnings and penalties. Thus, the youth was being educated politically. At a time when the citizens of a so-called national state, for the most part, knew little of their own nationality except the language. Of course, I did not belong to the lukewarm section. Within a little while, I had become an ardent German national, which had a different meaning from the party significance attached to the term today. Now, this is so important, such an important statement. Again, if you're following along, underline that, okay? Being a German national had a different meaning from the party significance attached to that term today. What does he mean by that? Well, the conservative party, when you hear guys like Charlie Kirk or Donald Trump say that, I'm a nationalist, are they? Do you ever hear either of those men speak about white people? The people that founded America, the nation that created the country, the concept of America? No, they don't. That's weird. So they're not nationalists. They're patriots posing as nationalists, right? And that's the difference he's trying to draw here between the two. I developed very rapidly in the nationalist direction. And by the time I was 15 years old, I had come to understand the distinction between dynastic patriotism and folkish nationalism. My sympathies being entirely in favor of the latter, even in those days. Such a preference may not perhaps be clearly intelligible to those who have never taken the trouble to study the internal conditions that prevailed in Austria under the Habsburg monarchy. In Austria, it was world history as taught in schools that served to sow the seeds of this development. For Austrian history, as such, is practically non-existent. The fate of this state was closely bound up with the existence and development of Germany as a whole. So that a division of history into German history and Austrian history is practically inconceivable. And indeed, it was only when the German people came to be divided between two states that this division began to make German history. The insignia of a former imperial sovereignty, which were still preserved in Vienna, appeared to act as a magic guarantee of an everlasting bond of union. When the Habsburg state crumbled to pieces in 1918, the Austrian Germans instinctively raised an outcry for union with their German mother country. That was the voice of unanimous yearning in the hearts of the whole people for return to the unforgotten home of their fathers. But such a general yearning could not be explained except by the historical training through which the individual Austrian Germans had passed. It was a spring that never dried up. Especially in times of distraction and forgetfulness, its quiet voice was a reminder of the past, bidding the people to look beyond the mere well-being of the moment to a new future. The teaching of universal history in what are called the higher grade schools is still very unsatisfactory. I see someone, this is just an important point in chat, someone says, I have an audiobook of this book and the reader makes him sound mean and crazy. This is pretty typical, which is why I like to analyze this book and read it, because first off, I don't believe anybody else really does this live, and I don't believe people add a lot of analysis to the book, which if you don't have a lot of, you know, gusto for these kind of topics, it can be a little bit like, it can be a lot, you know, to read all of this stuff. So it's really important when you find those really important pieces to kind of really hammer home, like this is what he's pointing at, you know, really think about this. And the average person that has done an audiobook on this, it's either the audiobook is like an AI or it's in a robotic voice, or it's from a guy who, again, like you said, they're reading it like Hitler's evil, like when the Habsburg state crumbled to pieces, you know, like they try to read it like it's coming from this dark, repulsive force or something. It's very sickening. So someone needs to read this book with the enthusiasm that he penned down into the paper himself, because it's very clear he was extremely enthusiastic on these topics. This next piece is also very important, and I want to recommend that if you are following along physically, that you take this paragraph into serious account. Write some notes on this one. Few teachers realize that the purpose of teaching history is not the memorizing of some dates and facts, that it does not matter whether a boy knows the exact date of a battle or the birthday of some marshal or other, nor when the crown of his fathers was placed on the brow of some insignificant monarch. That is not what matters. To study history means to search for and discover the forces that are the causes of those results which appear before our eyes as historical events. The art of reading and studying consists in remembering the essentials and forgetting what is inessential. It's really important. Okay, and especially when it comes to the study of history and his explanation of history. So, does it matter if you know what year your founding fathers made the country? Does that matter? when we talk about the Declaration of Independence and the American Revolution, what matters more? Knowing the date that the revolution started, or knowing why those men started the revolution? What's more important? Is it more important to analyze, oh, this happened on this year by these men? Or is it more important to analyze, these men did it because this was happening to them? That is what spawned them to create this, and we have this because of the mistakes there, or because of the achievements here. That's the piece of history that you want to be studying. The actual, the nuances to the events, not the events themselves. Probably my whole future life was determined by the fact that I had a teacher of history who understood, as few others understand, how to make this viewpoint prevail in teaching and in examining. This teacher was Dr. Leopold Poitsch of the Realschule at Linz. He was the ideal personification of the qualities necessary to a teacher of history in the sense I have mentioned above. An elderly gentleman with a decisive manner but a kindly heart. He was a very attractive speaker and was able to inspire us with his own enthusiasm. Even today, I cannot recall without emotion that venerable personality whose enthusiastic exposition of history so often made us entirely forget the present and allow ourselves to be transported, as if by magic, into the past. He penetrated through the dim mist of thousands of years and transformed the historical memory of the dead into a living reality. When we listened to him, we became afire with enthusiasm, and we were sometimes moved even to tears. It was still more fortunate that this master was able not only to illustrate the past by examples from the present, but from the past, he was also able to draw a lesson for the present. He understood better than any other the everyday problems that were then agitating our minds. The national fervor which we felt in our own small way was utilized by him as an instrument of our education, inasmuch as he often appealed to our national sense of honor, for in that way he maintained order and held our attention much more easily than he could have done by any other means. It was because I had such a master that history became my favorite subject. As a natural consequence, but without the conscious connivance of my teacher, I then and there became a young rebel. But who could have studied German history under such a teacher and not become an enemy of the state whose rulers exercised such a disastrous influence on the destinies of the German nation? Now, that's a big one as well. Really want to highlight that one, really underline that one. It's a really important one, okay? How can you get a real sense of history? American history. If you really understand American history, what the founding fathers stood for, right? What these people care about, what they're driven by. If you have a true understanding of that, how the hell could you appreciate the system we have right now? You couldn't. If you appreciate the system, you obviously don't know what our founding fathers stood for. Every founding father, without exception, spoke negatively upon democracy as a state form. Every political leader of the last two decades has spoken positively of democracy and referred to our country as such. Do you hear Donald Trump or George Bush, the so-called Republicans, ever call America a constitutional republic? No! They say it's a democracy. We have to defend our democracy. Well, clearly they're not in line with what the founding fathers believed in. They're cowards. They're scumbags. They know nothing about the foundation of this country. They don't care about it. Further. Finally, how could one remain a faithful subject of the House of Habsburg, whose past history and present conduct proved it to be ready, ever and always, to betray the interests of the German people for the sake of paltry personal interests Does that sound familiar, folks? Does that sound kind of like Donald Trump through AIPAC, who never will advocate for the white populace, who is his majority voting base, who constitutes the majority of this country, the majority of the working class? He never speaks on their behalf. Why? Because he doesn't want to lose that AIPAC funding. He doesn't want to be called a white supremacist or an evil neo-Nazi. So he doesn't speak for white people because of his own personal interests. Did not we, as youngsters, fully realize that the House of Habsburg did not and could not have any love for us Germans? What history taught us about the policy followed by the House of Habsburg was corroborated by our own everyday experiences. In the North and in the South, the poison of foreign races was eating into the body of our people, and even Vienna was steadily becoming more and more a non-German city. The Imperial House favored the Czechs on every possible occasion. So now he's saying, in the same regard, he's saying that if you're living in a state and all of these foreigners are coming in, okay, now again, at the time it wasn't, you know, black and brown foreigners, but all these foreigners are coming in and they're being praised and they're being put ahead of the host people. You see this in America today. Blacks come in on mass scale. They're already here on mass scale. And what's happening? They're getting DEI quotas. They're put in front of us in the line. Blacks are allowed to have all black universities. Blacks are allowed to have all black businesses and promote them as such. Are white people allowed to do that in their own country that they supposedly control with white supremacy and their white privilege? I don't think so. If you go ahead, go make a billboard that says white pride's a good thing. In no time at all, CNN and the New York Times will be picking up anti-Semitic billboard in Times Square because it's advocating for white people. And they'll use every means at their disposal. Economic, social pressure, you name it. They'll use all of those means to ensure that you can't make that advocacy. I see we got a couple super chats. Hicks, brother, thank you very much for the $21 super chat on FTJ. Thank you, sir. Really appreciate the support over there. Lowest fees. Really do appreciate people throwing their super chats over there. And we got Keep Asking for Truth with a 1933 super chat. Very interesting amount. I see why, though. I like that. Very very cryptic. Nice one. He says, Logos is the order of things. Here is some other form of energy for your great thoughts. Respect the Logos and our people will thrive. Read books or you shall be Goyim and be treated accordingly. Very well said. Thank you, brother. Really appreciate the support. And don't forget, folks, if you do want to support the show, you can super chat through any of the platforms that we are on. Entropy, Odyssey, FTJ, Rumble, you name it. All of the options are there, and they're all greatly appreciated. Continuing. What history taught us about the policy followed by the House of Habsburg was Indeed, it was the hand of the goddess of eternal justice and inexorable retribution that caused the most deadly enemy of Germanism in Austria, the Archduke Franz Ferdinand, to fall by the very bullets which he himself had helped to cast. He was the prime mover in the work begun by the ruling classes of turning Austria into a Slav state. So what he's stating, for those who are not familiar, I do want to just really quickly pull this up, because it's important what he's describing here. So what he's describing is Franz Ferdinand was murdered by a Slavic person who, again, what Hitler's saying is, these aren't Slavic countries. There shouldn't be Slavic people in here, right? He was murdered by a Slavic person named Gavrilo Princip, okay? And this would be the same as, for instance, Joe Biden, who's like, we need more immigrants. Diversity is our strength. He invites all the blacks and browns in, and then he gets killed by one of them, right? It's like, well, you sowed those seeds, right? Like, a lot of people look at the videos. You've seen videos of, like, liberals getting beat up by blacks on the street. And I hate this take. I do, actually. I hate this take from conservatives. They'll say, "Oh, well, those liberal women, they voted for this, so I like watching them get beat up by black people." No. Our liberal women need guidance. Women are never going to vote correctly on their own account. They need guidance, okay? And our men should be standing for them rather than against them. I find that absolutely repulsive. In this case, when we're talking about a leader of a country fomenting this, seeding this, and then reaping the consequences, now I agree it's a good thing to watch. But not I'm sorry. That conservative take of like watching our women get beat up by black dudes in the city because they voted for it. Well, that's what the Democrats wanted. Like, shut the fuck. You're actually, that's the most individualistic like scumbag. Yeah, it's sports ball. It's political sports ball. I'm Republican. Fuck those Democrats. My team needs to win. Like, okay, you're watching your own people die at the expense of winning a political race, you know, because you want Republicans to be in, and they don't even advocate for you anyway. So it's just it's scummy. I hate that. Absolutely repulsive. The burdens laid on the shoulders of the German people were enormous, and the sacrifices of money and blood which they had to make were incredibly heavy. Yet anybody who was not quite blind must have seen that it was all in vain. What affected us most bitterly was the consciousness of the fact that this whole system was morally sanctioned by the alliance with Germany, whereby the slow extirpation of the Germanism in the old Austrian monarchy seemed in some way to be more or less countenanced by Germany herself. Habsburg hypocrisy, which endeavored outwardly to make the people believe that Austria still remained a German state, increased the feeling of hatred against the imperial house, and at the same time aroused a spirit of rebellion and contempt. Only in the German Reich itself did those who were then its rulers fail to understand what all this meant. As if struck blind, they stood beside a corpse, and the very symptoms of decomposition, they believed that they recognized the signs of renewed vitality. And again, this is something that is eerily similar to our circumstances today, right? DEI is destroying the fabric of our country today. It's destroying the fabric of it. And we have these rulers praising it as if it's some kind of, as he says, renewed vitality. Like it's this great thing that's just saving us from all of our struggles. We need more Indians. We need more Indians. Come on, man. They're killing us. They're literally extincting us and praising it as if it's this great thing. We got Kate Hikes with a $5 super chat. Thank you very much. Says, he was a Serb nationalist and was killed in Bosnia under occupation of Austria-Hungary Kingdom. So how is that like Nigs killing white women? And why would you compare South slaves to Nigs? Yeah, well, first off, thank you for the super chat. I think you're really conflating. I was not comparing Nigs to Slavic people. I was saying a foreigner in a country being allowed by the ruling class of that country, and I wasn't comparing it to the white woman example. I was actually very clear about that. A foreigner in a country, okay, coming into that country by the approval and the policy of the leader and then causing havoc for that leader, okay? I was comparing the circumstance, not the people, okay? And certainly, like I said, I am not okay with the women being murdered, and I don't consider that a comparison at all. I think that's terrible. I was comparing it to Joe Biden if he were to be killed tomorrow by some fucking ghetto chimp, because Mr. Joe Biden praises DEI and he has the power to make those policies put into play. Then I think it would be actually hilarious. I think it'd be comedy. Pretty ironic, it would be. Thank you again for the super chat. I hope it cleared up that misunderstanding. Okay, further. In that unhappy alliance between the young German Empire and the illusory Austrian state lay the germ of the World War and also of the final collapse. In subsequent passages of this book, I shall go into the root of this problem. Suffice it here to say that in the very early years of my youth, I came to certain conclusions, which I have never abandoned. Indeed, I became more profoundly convinced of them as the years passed. They were, firstly, that the dissolution of the Austrian Empire was a preliminary condition for the safeguarding of German nationality and culture. Furthermore, that national feeling is by no means identical with dynastic patriotism, and above all, that the House of Habsburg was destined to bring misfortune on the German nation. Now, to draw a comparison to America, let's say we're using America as the circumstance, the House of Habsburg in America would be like the Jewish oligarchy today, right? Getting rid of them, because they're destined to bring misfortune on America rather than the German nation. The dissolution of the American political body right now, this two-party system, is a preliminary condition for the safeguarding of white people, okay? And national feeling, okay, this is, we already talked about this one, is not identical to dynastic patriotism. Again, so faggots like Charlie, faggot, traitorous pieces of garbage, really hope he sees every time I say this, I hate this guy, like Charlie Kirk, okay? When they say patriotism, they're talking about a love for the two-party democratic system that's destroying our fucking country, right? The fabric of the nation is being destroyed by this two-party democratic system that Charlie Kirk praises, right? When I say I'm a nationalist, I'm very clear. I don't give a shit about this two-party system. Actually, on the contrary, I want it gone because it is destructive to our nation. And if we ever want our nation to have sovereign advocacy for itself, we need a new system in play that is purely nationalistic, not patriotic. I see, Kate. I understand. Yeah, apologies for the confusion on my end. Continuing. As a logical consequence of these convictions, there arose in me a feeling of intense love for my German-Austrian home and a profound hatred for the Austrian state. Again, not the Austrian people, the state. The way of looking at history, which was developed in me through my study of history at school, never left me afterwards. World history became more and more an inexhaustible source for the understanding of contemporary historical events, which means politics. Therefore, I would not learn history, but let history teach me. A precocious revolutionary in politics, I was no less a precocious revolutionary in art. At that time, the provincial capital of Upper Austria had a theater, which, relatively speaking, was not bad. Almost everything was produced there. When I was 12 years old, I saw a performance of Wilhelm Tell there. That was my first experience of the theater. Some months later, I attended a performance of Lohengrin, the first opera I had ever heard. I was fascinated at once. My youthful enthusiasm for the Bayreuth master knew no bounds. Again and again, I was drawn to hear his operas, and today, I consider it a great piece of luck that these modest productions in that little provincial city prepared the way and made it possible for me to appreciate better productions later on. All this helped to intensify my profound aversion for the career that my father had chosen for me. And this dislike became especially strong as the rough corners of youthful boorishness were worn down, a process which, in my case, was fraught with a good deal of pain. I became more and more convinced that I should never be happy as a government official. And now that the real Schule had recognized and acknowledged my aptitude for drawing, my resolution became all the stronger. We got another super chat from Keep Asking for Truth. Thank you. The 255 says, a lot of love to women, yet they actually don't have a deep understanding of self-determination that is necessary for politics. If the tribe won, it stayed the same. If they lost, they became the woman of the winner. Men's genes died or survived. Women weren't selected for political awareness. Facts. Yeah, you know, this is just a reality of human nature. Women are not politically inclined. Women are not massive risk takers. It's just not something that interests them. It's not something that takes their grasp psychologically. They're very emotional creatures. They care a lot less about philosophy and, you know, deep analysis of things than men do, right? And they also don't have that competitive drive. Politics has a lot of competitive nature in it. It's not really a common female trait. So there's a nature in this. And I'm a strong believer, like, you know, I kind of hate this term, like, simping and white knighting. Like, I do agree there is, like, a balance to these things with, like, putting women on a pedestal and over-praising them and kind of, like, you know, giving them full control over everything, right, in your life, in your livelihood. But I think people take that to a different extreme with the simping and this white knighting thing, because there is a level of protection that women are required. You know, men should be looking out for women spiritually and protecting them. And just as an example, very recently we had Lily Gaddis on my show, who, you know, she's getting these constant claims against her that she's Jewish and she's subversive or whatever. I fundamentally don't believe that that's true. I've looked into the evidence. I don't think she's Jewish. So I find it an obligatory duty to defend her, because women aren't meant to fend for themselves against hordes of accusations and, you know, these political onslaughts. It's not in their nature. So I believe somebody has to do it for them. So if she's Jewish, dude, like, I'll eat my shirt, right? I'll absolutely admit that I was wrong, and I'm very mistaken in that regard. But I don't believe she is. So with that knowledge, or with my understanding of the situation, it's my absolute duty to defend her. I'm sorry. It's not like, that's not simping or being some kind of cock faggot. It's like, somebody should be fending for her when there's a bunch of fucking prepubescent teens calling her a kike online. It's exhausting. You know, it's destructive to her image. Meanwhile, I don't even really believe that she should be in a political position. It's just the unfortunate circumstance that we have in society today. I would much rather see her with 5 children, you know, cooking for them and upkeeping a nice household at home, and maybe making a show where she talks about cooking and cleaning, or where she talks about how to take care of children appropriately, or whatever the case may be. Something that has a more feminine nature to it. Continuing onward. Imprecations and threats had no longer any power to change it. I wanted to become a painter, and no power on earth could force me to become a civil servant. The only peculiar feature of the situation now was that I grew bigger. I became more and more interested in architecture. Lisa, I disagree with you, actually. Most women that follow me completely agree with that statement. Women are... It's not insulting to state that women are emotional creatures. That's a very positive thing. I'll give you a very good example of this. Babysitting. Why are women better at babysitting than men? Because they're very tapped into that emotional nature. They are empathetic. They can feel with that child. When that child is upset, they can feel for that. They care for that. There's a deep resonance with that. Men don't have that ability. I don't want a dude babysitting my kids. If I had children, I would never let a dude babysit my children. Why? Because men aren't emotionally inclined. They're logically inclined. The only time that logic becomes clouded by men is when their emotions do kick in. And then when that's the case, they're either angry or they're completely sexually driven. Very, very few other circumstances where that's not the case. So when I say women are emotional creatures, that's in defense of them. It's not an attack. I considered this fact as a natural complement of my talent for painting, and I rejoiced inwardly that the sphere of my artistic interests was thus enlarged. I had no notion that one day it would have to be otherwise. The question of my career was decided much sooner than I could have foreseen. When I was in my 13th year, my father was suddenly taken from us. He was still in robust health when a stroke of apoplexy painlessly ended his earthly sojourn and left us all deeply bereaved. His most ardent longing was to be able to help his son to advance in a career and thus save him from the harsh ordeal that he himself had to undergo. But it appeared then as if that longing were in vain. And yet, though he himself was not conscious of it, he had sown the seeds of a future which neither of us foresaw at that time. At first, nothing was changed outwardly. My mother felt it her duty to continue my education in accordance with my father's wishes, which meant that she would have me study for the civil service. For my own part, I was even more firmly determined than ever before that in no circumstances would I become a government official. The curriculum and teaching methods followed in the higher grade school were so far removed from my ideals that I became profoundly indifferent. Illness suddenly came to my assistance. Within a few weeks, it decided my future and put an end to the long-standing family conflict. My lungs became so seriously affected that the doctor advised my mother very strongly not in any circumstance to allow me to take up a career which would necessitate working in an office. He ordered that I should give up attending the real Shula for at least a year. What I had secretly desired for such a long time and had persistently fought for now suddenly became a reality without effort on my part. Influenced by my illness, my mother agreed that I should leave the real Shula and attend the academy. Those were happy days, which appeared to me almost like a dream, and they were doomed to remain only a dream. 2 years later, my mother's death put a brutal end to all my fine projects. She succumbed to a long and painful illness, which from the very beginning permitted little help of recovery. Though expected, her death came as a terrible blow to me. I respected my father, but I loved my mother. Poverty and stern reality forced me to decide promptly. The meager resources of the family had been almost entirely used up through my mother's severe illness. The allowance which came to me as an orphan was not enough for the bare necessities of life. Somehow or other, I would have to earn my own bread. With my clothes and linen packed in a valise, and with an indomitable resolution in my heart, I left for Vienna. I hoped to forestall fate, as my father had done 50 years before. I was determined to become somebody, but certainly not a civil servant. That's chapter one, folks. I hope we all enjoyed the first reading of Mein Kampf. Again, I always like to ask just to gauge, how was the analysis? Is it a good analysis? Is there too much, too little? Is there problems with the analysis where you're uncomfortable with it? Is it too tacky inside of the reading? I'm very curious. Excuse me. Oh, boy. Again, that was first episode of this. We're going to be doing this for all the future Logos Academies until the book is through. And I think the analysis will come... it'll come a little more in handy in like the second and third chapter when he starts getting political, explaining how the system functions, explaining the corruptions of the system, because then it's really important to relate it to the modern day, kind of give people that understanding of just exactly how serious it is and how not much is different than what he was experiencing then. And when you realize how similar the circumstances are, then you also realize that the conclusion is similar, right? How we fix it, the resolution to this. With that said, folks, that's a perfect timing, actually. We got 10 minutes left on the show. I do apologize. I saw a lot of people are chatting here and there. It's really hard to read a book, analyze the book, and read chats in the chat room at the same time. So do excuse me. I will, you know, if I'm doing the reading and we get super chats, I will allow the super chats to kind of pop in and I'll address those. But it's really hard to read like all of the chats that are going on, so. Yeah, Envy, he says, you're not pushing that Jewish propaganda like others do when they read or cover it. Yeah. And that's a big reason that I'm trying to do this is a lot of people, you're either reading a Jewish version of Mein Kampf, you're getting a Jewish analysis of Mein Kampf, Jewish annotations around Mein Kampf, a Jewish perspective from Mein Kampf, or you're just getting somebody that doesn't have enthusiasm for the work, right? And I'm sorry, this book, I'm enthusiastic about this book. You'll probably see me more enthusiastic reading this book than you'll see me pretty much doing anything else on my show. So, very, very enthusiastic about this. Hello, Goose. Welcome, welcome, brother. Can you see the cover? Yeah, of course. This is the cover of the Stalag edition. Again, if you guys want to get the Stalag edition, you want a physical copy, moneytreepublishing.com. Okay, when you go to check out, code LOGOS, LOGOS, and you're going to save yourself 10% on the book. I'm going to get a small royalty for that, and you're also supporting a guy that is part of our movement. So it's a win-win-win. Thank you, Timmy. Very well said. And I completely agree with you. And I do want to say thank you guys again for all of the super chats. Don't forget, if you guys do want to support the show, help me maintain doing this as full time as possible in this corrupt, repulsive Jewish system. All of the options to do so are through super chats. We also have crypto wallets. They're in the BioStream link down below. In the description of the stream, you guys can support through Odyssey, Rumble, FTJ, Entropy, whatever you fancy. I do always recommend, excuse me, I do always recommend FTJ. They have the lowest processor fee, so the middleman is not Jewing the hell out of us in between these things. So I always do recommend that. Sorry, I was thinking of the numbers. It's a 3.5% processing fee on FTJ. Rumble is 20%. Entropy is 15%. Odyssey is 8.5%. So, giving a lot less to the middleman if you support through FTJ. You don't have to do it there. I know it's a little bit of a newer platform, so some people maybe aren't comfortable yet. But I do recommend it. It's a very trustworthy site. I know the owner personally. He's a very nice guy. Been very fair to me. So, thank you guys again for all the support on the show. I really do appreciate it. With that said, we're going to close up. I haven't eaten yet today. I got to make myself some food. I'm very hungry. We won't be live this weekend, but we're going to be live on Monday. FTJ, folks, is FTJmedia.com. Stands for Freedom, Truth, Justice. It's a free speech platform. It can also stand for something else if you're really smart. So we will be live on Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. We're going to continue on the reading. We're going to be picking up on chapter 2. Again, we are doing the Stalag edition of Mein Kampf for anybody following along. And then afterwards, I'm actually going to be in that Twitter space discussing, National Socialism and kind of what we're doing moving forward. So make sure you catch that Twitter space too if you want to see where this thing goes, if you want some advice as to where this goes. Additionally, one other thing I want to announce. I am going to be setting up a Telegram chat room, a cultured Telegram chat room for young men to join, to get involved, to start getting book recommendations, to skill share with each other, to educate each other, to build connections, socialize, whatever you feel comfortable with. We're going to start building a community of white men. And this is going to be on Telegram. We're going to start it up. Give us some years. This will turn into a physical thing as well. I know I've had a lot of people pressuring me lately. They're like, get into the IRL shit. Where's the IRL? Like, it takes time. It takes time. It takes time, right? These things require finances, organization. Last thing I want to do is just like hop into the IRL side of things, and I'm like disorganized, and I'm fucking up and making mistakes, and getting guys arrested or just doing dumb shit, right? So these things take time. Please understand that. Because I had a lot of people like tell me about this. I get it. I totally understand. But we have to be patient with the IRL thing. That's something that I'm very fresh in this, man. I've only been around for 2 years. So a lot of people that are working on IRL, they're like in their 40s, 50s. They've been around for a long time. I'm fortunately new to this. Fortunately and unfortunately, right? I came in at a good time, but it's also unfortunate because I have a lot of things that I have to organize and get together within myself and within the things around me. Keep asking for truth with a $1 super chat on Odyssey. Thank you, sir. He says, you should set up a shadow chat. I'm not familiar with shadow chat. He says, that's based as fuck. Check it out. I'll look into it. I'm not familiar with it. But we are setting up a Telegram channel. I'll be promoting. We have a name for it. It's going to have a mission statement on it. It's going to have a rule set on it. Like, we don't want people coming in there fucking, like, meme spamming or, like, post, like, self-promoting links and stuff. And that's what a lot of Telegrams kind of degenerate into. We want to keep it, like, a cultured atmosphere where people are actually having good discussions. They're helping each other. They're collaborating with each other. They're building bonds and relationships with each other. That's kind of the goal that we have with that. So, Korth, welcome, welcome. It's going good. Thank you. You missed a really nice first chapter of Mein Kampf. You can always watch a rebroadcast. It's there. Okay, with that said, folks, I'll see you guys on Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. I see someone asked my pendant. This is a Roman coin from ancient Rome. It's got a Roma on the front and Romulus and Remulus on the back. Actual coin from ancient Rome. Okay, thank you, folks. See you guys on Monday, 4 p.m. Eastern. We're going to be picking up on Chapter 2 of Mein Kampf. And then we're going to be doing a space right afterwards. So I'll promote the space the day of a little bit more. All right, thank you guys. Have a good one. I really do appreciate all of the chats, all of the super chats, and the company on today's show. Really hope reading this to you guys in an audiobook format will inspire some more people to pick up the book and read it for themselves. It's a very very fundamental work. It's absolutely a must read in today's atmosphere. So, all right, thank you guys. Really appreciate it. Have a wonderful night and a good weekend as well.